Accession number 30249, Reel 12.
Gordon Rushmer, Reel 11. Before you take me back to Afghanistan, Gordon, when you came home, were you well enough to get on with any work?
Yes.
Having done all these sketches and you were saying how earlier your model, were you able to make a start?
Oh, yes, I started straight away. Yeah. I mean, I may have had a day sitting around, but no, I was back working. Pretty much straight away.
I imagine. Is that right? You hadn't actually completed.
No, I mean, it took me a while to put all the ideas together and then produce. I mean, I suppose I didn't produce the finished painting for about. That took me about 3 months, I suppose. By which time I'd been to Afghanistan again and come back, and you know. So I'm splicing all these things together, really. And there's one thing I forgot that I ought to say about this first trip. It's only just come to me, really. The Northern Alliance general who hosted us, who was the second in command, I got on really well with this chap through the interpreter. And at one point, I was asking him about the war that was going on and where he'd come from and what his experiences were, and I just said how did you become part of the Northern Alliance? Which was an innocent question, and he smiled and then he laughed and he said, until 3 months ago, I was a general in the Taliban army, but I like to fight on the winning side. And that's another Afghan quality. I mean, that illustrated so well that I'd like to fight on the winning side, and they do. I mean, they will, and he'd obviously taken he'd swapped sides with probably, you know, I don't know how many thousand soldiers as well, but he would have, yeah. But he just grinned at me, you know, when he said it, you know. And that's the way it works. You know, they're very laid back about these things, really. You know, if you're losing, why take a good kicking when you could be on the other side?
Do you yourself see any signs of the Taliban? I think you mentioned earlier the bridge being.
Yes, I mean you saw signs like that, and also I mean the mountain road between Bagram Air Base and Kabul, which was the road, funny, that was the road that John Simpson had travelled down with the Northern Alliance when they'd liberated Kabul. I mean, I think John Simpson probably liberated Kabul single-handed. he travelled down on the initial push, and I was there, I mean, just a few months after. But when they'd gone down across this mountain road, they at the top of the pass across this mountain, the Taliban had a checkpoint for controlling the flow of traffic. So they drove the Taliban away from this checkpoint, and as they pushed through, the Northern Alliance left two guards on this checkpoint, and then the whole force moved down into Kabul. Well, when they came back the very next day, they found the heads of these two Northern Alliance guards impaled upon metal spikes on both sides of the road at this checkpoint. And those heads were there for 3 months. I didn't see them. They were gone by the time I got there. But, I mean, it had been one of the sort of tourist spots on the road to Kabul, you know, and it was pointed out to me that if you'd have been a month earlier, you know, and I mean, and that illustrates how barbaric they are. You know, they're quite happy to change sides and do all that sort of thing, but they can be incredibly cruel. They're harsh people, and they mete out punishment at will. quite sobering.
Here you were going back.
And here I am going back again. Yeah. And this time, of course, I'm with the Royal Marines, which isn't quite the same as the Special Boat Service. I mean, they're just one step down, one small step down. But I again, I flew into Kabul, and this time I had a day and a half at our base in Kabul. They held me at the base in Kabul until they were ready to drive me north. So I had I had a day sightseeing, first of all in Kabul, and in the 6 weeks since I'd been there before, things had improved without doubt. It was quite noticeable that people were more friendly in the streets, and that the commercial side of Kabul was up and running, and some businesses were obviously thriving by then. So the carpet souvenir type businesses were, you know, selling all sorts of goodies. But anyway, so I was taken to Chicken Street for a second time to view the carpets and the sights, looked at the British Embassy and one or two other things. So that was, I knew what to expect on the second visit, which was really quite useful when you go into a country like that, because I was prepared. Although I've thought since that I think sometimes ignorance is bliss. It's better not to know what you're going into. But on this occasion, yes, I was prepared, and I decided I was only going to drink water out of bottles, and I was only going to eat food that came out of sealed packets or out of from Royal Marine canteens. I wasn't going to eat any local food or anything like that. So I tightened up on that, which stood me in good stead, you know. Anyway, I met my friend Jeff, and I travelled up to Bagram Air Base in his armoured Land Rover, which was great fun, because we drove up across this mountain road. Which was lovely, lovely, lovely drive, you know. I mean, it's high and it's a narrow road, and just a beautiful piece of country again. Anyway, on the journey, Jeff laughed and said to me, "We've come at the right time, because the Taliban have been on local radio this week offering money for the heads of the invaders." You know, so that was us and the Americans. And he said, "But you'll be pleased to know." You'll be really pleased to know they're offering $1,000 for the head of an American soldier and $10,000 for the head of a Royal Marine. And the boys were absolutely jubilant about this. I mean, you know, that they'd got the Taliban on the run, and the Taliban knew who were the real fighters and who weren't, you know. So every one Royal Marine is worth 10 Americans. Shouldn't be quoted in public, really, for saying that, but you know, it's quite amusing that there was this imbalance in the amount of money they were offering, you know. But that had certainly affected safety. I mean, there were people at the end of the runway in Bagram Air Base, trying to bring down planes at night, and I had rocks thrown at me one day in Kabul, and that raised the tension a little, you know, the fact that they were offering money like that. So it made, in that respect, it made life a little uncomfortable, I suppose. But my job on this second trip was to produce one painting depicting the Royal Marines Logistic Regiment deployment into Afghanistan, and that was the brief, pure and simple, really. There was a budget, and I was there to come up with ideas, and they would do whatever whatever I wanted, really, to show me everything, you know. So I decided that I would travel on their convoys. They were running road convoys up from Kabul and back, pretty much on a daily basis, shipping ammunition and food and all sorts of things. So so I spent time going backwards and forwards over this mountain road in convoys. I'd just sit in the cab of a vehicle with a driver, and we'd trundle along, and every so often we'd break down, and the whole convoy would stop and they'd repair a vehicle, and then we'd move on again. And on one of the trips, we were right up on this pass, and there weren't that many vehicles. There were probably 15 big lorries in this convoy, sort of low-loader lorries, you know. And we suddenly came to a stop for no apparent reason, right up on the top of this mountain. And I think I was probably in the second vehicle. Anyway, we all came to a stop. And I saw a Royal Marine hop out of the cab of the vehicle in front, and he scampered round to the front of the lorry. And what he'd done, he'd spotted a tortoise in the road. So they stopped the whole convoy, and this big butch marine gets out and picks this tortoise up out of the road and carries it into the bush and pops it down, and then off we go again. I mean, who else would do that? You know, it was one of those lighter moments, really, you know. And we all had there was much comment from various drivers about having to stop for a tortoise.
But mine or something.
Yes, yeah. But yeah, well, that was a nice touch, that, actually. Anyway, so I used to raise the lid on the cab, and I could stand up with my head out the top, which is a pretty silly thing to do in hostile country, I suppose. But it was quite obvious there weren't many naughty people around, you know. But I could get out the top and look around and take photographs, and the result of that part of the journey is this painting that you can see here, which is the tail end of a convoy dashing back through in the dusk.
It is beautiful.
To Bagram Air
Base.
Yeah. Well, it's the yeah. These are sort of salt marshes, really, because although it's high country, you get these areas of salt marsh, like you do in most deserts, really. And this particular road had been mined by the Taliban, and you can see the holes where they'd popped the mines. So you sweep for the mines, and then hope to goodness they don't come back the next night and put them back again, you know. But I mean, generally, I guess you drive around the holes just to make sure. And the sides of the road were all mined, so. And on this stretch, definitely, it was all mined. So if you came under attack, you couldn't get off the road, because you'd be straight into a minefield. So you travel with a lot of space between each vehicle for a start, and you just hope to goodness that you don't get attacked. I mean, I went through a drill on this trip about what to do if you're attacked, you know, well, because you can't run anywhere much. You can get under the vehicle, but there's not much else you can do. And I had mine awareness training on this trip. They're much more practical than the SPS, these people, you know. But we were in areas where there were minefields, and you might just through being absent-minded walk off the road and walk into something, you know.
Particularly doing your work, I would think, you know, sketching,
yeah,
and, you know, getting at the right sort of angle. Where did you have those courses?
At the base at Bagram Air Base.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so all new arrivals, basically, I mean, military or non-military, you have to have, certainly there, you had to have, you just sat for an hour and somebody showed you lots of horrible photographs of maimed people and bits of people, and so you know what a mine can do to you. That never leaves you. But then they tell you how to recognise mines and what to do if you suddenly find you're in a minefield, you know, this is the procedure that you follow, you know.
What do you do?
Well, I've done it once since. If you can, then you come out the way you walked in and you walk in the same footprints. So it's best to do it in sand, you know, so you can see where you've walked. And it happened to me in Iraq. Through sheer excitement that I thought I was going to get an angle on something. And that if I dashed across into the desert 50 odd metres and I got a shot of this thing from a different angle, it would be, you know, I'd get a better picture. And for the only time to date, I forgot myself and I left this road and scampered across the desert. And I got maybe, I don't know, 30 or 40 feet. And a sergeant shouted, he just said one word, mines. And I just stopped dead and thought, oh God, you know, what have I done, you know. And I looked at him and he looked at me and then he said, you're right, you know what to do. And I said, yeah, I'm fine, I know what to do. So I was able to turn around and I just walked back in the same footprints, you know. It's very easy to do. For somebody like me, you get swept away by the occasion, you know, and you see, you can see a picture, you know, and you think, oh, you know, this is what I'm here for, and you can forget what can happen to you if you don't stay alert, you know. So yeah, and that, I mean, that you run that risk all the time. You mustn't forget where you are. And at the end of the day, survival comes first and good picture comes second. But that was very useful, mind awareness. That trip, nothing very exciting happened, really, I suppose. I mean, I trundled backwards and forwards on convoys and looked at the view and looked at the sunsets and painted the dust storms. And we didn't come under fire. So it was quite a straightforward thing to do, but it was also a very good trip. I was included in all the briefings, which was good. So in the evenings, I mean, they have like a, I don't know what you want to call it, a prayer meeting every night. So all the officers get together and the CO is there and they run through operations, what's happening around and about and what they've got to do, where have we got to take stuff, what's happening, who's doing this, who's doing that. So you have this hour or so briefing and discussion every night. And I was included in all those, which is quite a privilege, actually, just to see how these people work. And again, there, I mean, I was invited in and introduced to everybody. This is Gordon, he's the war artist, you know, look out for him. And then I could just sit in a corner with a glass of Coca-Cola while they went about their business, you know. And you pick up so much by watching these people work, you know. So it's not all blood and guts, and you know, just to see how the whole process of fighting a war gathers momentum and how it's maintained, and that's fascinating. It's all part of the job as well, to see, you know. And that was an aspect that I'd not really encountered before, you know. Of course, if you're with the logistical, then you're going to see all that planning and everything coming together, you know. And there, of course, the logistic corps, all the logistics people in all the forces are absolutely vital. Nothing happens without these people. Nothing moves, nothing, you know. You need your ammunition, somebody's got to bring it to you, your water, and these are the guys that do it. So it can be quite a dangerous job. You're very exposed shipping stuff around, you know, and quite often quite lightly armed as well, you know. So you it's still not a job. It's not a job for the softies. Logistics, you know, because you're moving around a lot, and you're probably travelling on well established routes and maybe to well established routines as well. So you've got to be jolly careful that people don't come for you, you know. So, and I found that whole thing absolutely fascinating, being with those guys, you know. And still, I mean, with the Royal Marines, they're all still commandos. They're all still fighting men. They just happen to not be doing the frontline job, if you like, you know. But they're ready to spring into action whenever the need arises, you know. And they were handing out water to the locals and things as we were driving around. There were always children in the middle of nowhere begging for water, and they'd usually stop and throw out a few bottles of water and things and then move off again, you know. So that sort of, well, that's the British hearts and minds.
Yes, I was way. Wondering, you know, since you came into it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this compassion thing, you know, from tortoises to children, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of, you see a lot of this compassion, you know, and it's... they just see somebody in a fix and try and help them out as they're passing through. Don't have to do it, but they do, you know, whenever it's practical, then they'll stop and say hi, and you know,
and it's sort of genuine.
Oh yeah.
Is it Gordon, yeah, it's we've got to do this.
No, it's no, I mean, I think I suspect we have a policy of hearts and minds, definitely. But you see it, when you see it working, it's just spontaneous, you know. It's compassionate people. That's all it is, really. And it operates, you know, right from giving sweets to kids or a bottle of water, you know, to sort of building schools and so on, you know.
Again, you were in a pretty privileged position, weren't
yes,
you, to be
yeah.
able to... observe the behaviour
yes,
of the troops.
Yes.
Did
yeah.
you get a feeling of how well sort of equipped they were in a personal sense? Were they sent into this war able to do the job and fully protected and resourced?
Well, I mean, training wise, they were well able, without doubt. I like to say that the British elite forces are probably the best trained in the world at all times, equipment or not, and put into a situation. I don't think equipment matters too much to these people. They'll get on with the job and do it damn well, equipment or not, you know. But having said that, it was quite obvious in those early days in Afghanistan that some of the weaponry wasn't the SA-80 assault rifle, for instance, was a real problem. It was jamming. You'd get off two or three rounds and then it would jam.
What was the number of that?
The SA-80. It's our standard British assault rifle that everybody carries. But at that stage, it just wasn't working properly. If it was too hot, it jammed. If it was too cold, it jammed. If it got dirty, it jammed. And they'd had a man from the ministry out because there had been a lot of complaints about this particular weapon. And this man had told the Royal Marines that they needed to clean their weapons more, that maybe if they cleaned their weapons six times a day, it would be okay. I mean, I wouldn't dare tell a Royal Marine to do anything, but I certainly wouldn't dare to tell a Royal Marine to clean his weapon. I think he was probably sent packing, that man, with a flea in his ear, you know. And that's been sorted, as far as I can tell. I mean, they've done lots of modifications to that weapon, and it it's a lot better now. I mean, I suspect now it's absolutely spot on. But there were occasions when boys were in minor skirmishes and were nearly overrun because their weapons jammed, you know, and that's not good enough. And I know, I mean, there were stories about not being supplied with desert boots, and again, that wouldn't bother most British soldiers. It bothers the media. Media make hay because you haven't got desert boots, you've only got black leather boots. They couldn't care a monkey, you know. I mean, these are tough guys. They, you know, all right, it's nice to have all the Gucci kit, but if you haven't got it, you haven't got it, you know. But providing you've got ammunition and weapons that work and drinking water, you're probably okay. And there were things like, there were mixes of uniform. I mean, in those early days, that you saw Marines with, like, for instance, a desert pattern trousers and European pattern shirts. They don't match, but I don't think it bothered those boys one jot, to be honest, you know, because they're trained to get on with the job. It's quite simple. So I feel a lot of these things are blown out of all proportion by the media. I'm not saying that there are not legitimate grouses sometimes. I mean, there are obviously grave shortages of helicopters in Afghanistan at the moment. And that, I mean, if you know, that's an important piece of equipment, a Chinook helicopter. And if you haven't got enough, you can't move people around, you can't move wounded people. You can't evacuate places fast, so it's a real handicap. And not putting fire retardant filler in the wings of Hercules airplanes and the like, you know, you could say it's unforgivable. I can't really comment with authority, but if it's there to be used, then why not use it? But it all costs money, and it's taxpayers' money that's paying for all this. So wars need financing, you know, and if there isn't enough money to go around, then there isn't enough money to go around, and things have to give. But that's where we, you know, then you get into the problems of being overstretched, and that's certainly a grave problem at the moment. Probably has been. It has been for several years. We're overstretched. We have neither the manpower or the finances to really support. We're doing it all on a shoestring, and we're doing it brilliantly. My God, are we doing it well? You know, but it relies.
Would the troops would talk about that? You know, would they discuss things like?
Not particularly, because I don't think. I'm not sure it really bothers them that much. They're there to do the job, and they get on and do it. You know, I mean, I suppose at